a meeting, and I have the pleasure of introducing our Carey lecturer this year. I actually asked for this job. It's something I don't usually do, but I have known Colin for a while, and I'm going to read you what is written up about him and then tell you about him. He is a recorded minister in Northwest Yearly Meeting and a member of North Valley Friends in Newburgh, Oregon. Colin and his wife Janine are the parents of four grown children. Recently, Colin concluded his work as General Secretary of Friends United Meeting. He served this global community of Quakers since 2011. Prior to joining the FUM staff, Colin was superintendent of Northwest Yearly Meeting for over 7 years, spent 16 years in pastoral ministry, and 10 years as an adjunct professor at George Fox University and Seminary. He has had the privilege of traveling among friends throughout the U.S. and across the globe. He holds a master's degree in theology, church history from Eastern Mennonite Seminary, and a doctoral degree in leadership spiritual formation from George Fox Seminary. I first met Colin in 2011 at the FUM Triennial. This was the first year he was working for FUM. And I was complaining that breakfast wasn't until 8 o'clock, and I needed coffee at 5:30 or 6. And Colin pointed out, there's coffee in the lobby 24 hours a day. We were in a hotel. So he also said that he needed coffee 5:30 or 6 in the morning. So we started a habit of meeting for coffee early in the morning when most other people weren't up yet. Maybe the second day, I expressed a concern that he was an evangelical friend, citing my difficult times with evangelicals, not friends, but other evangelicals who would ask me in a belligerent fashion, have you been saved? And there was no good answer to that. Either you say yes, and then they want you to know exactly when it happened and where it was, or you say no, not the way you mean it, and then they want to save you. So I had had very uncomfortable experiences. But that's not who Colin is. I have heard him speak, because of my intervisitation travels, I have heard him speak many times, and it's never the same thing. And that's amazing to me as a former Methodist minister. Most ministers will recycle their sermons. But he doesn't do that. He speaks directly to what the occasion is. If he's speaking to a yearly meeting that's suffering troubled times, or if he's speaking to a celebratory situation like a triennial, there are always fresh and new, always to the point. And I have now gone to 3 triennials where he has been there. And 1 year, it must have been 2014, everywhere I went on my visits, Colin was there. And he said, I'm stalking you. So that is my relationship with Colin and why I wanted to introduce him.
Good evening, friends. I've gotten to speak in front of hundreds of groups, and I have to say this is the first time I've ever gotten to raise the microphone after being introduced. think this is the happiest day of my life. Thank you for letting me come and be with you. I think this is the fourth time I've been to a BYM gathering, and I appreciate all your kindness and hospitality over the last couple days I've been here. And I also want to say I very much appreciate all of the gentle ways you treated me during the 7 years I served as FUM's General Secretary. That was a great gift, and I want to thank you. Thank you for it. The irony of being asked to speak about listening is not lost on me. More than ever, I'm mindful of just how hard it is to hear well. My wife and I just moved back from our home in Indiana to Oregon. When we settled in Indiana in 2012, we bought an old farmhouse that was built in 1890 with high ceilings and thick brick walls, small rooms, and wood floors. If we weren't standing next to each other, it was really hard to hear what the other one was saying. And so we spent a lot of time saying, "What?" and repeating ourselves to each other. Now, we prefer to use the design of the house as the problem, as our excuse for not hearing. It's more palatable to us than the onset of old age or the possibility that we just might not be listening to each other as well after 30-some years of marriage. Well, now we're back in Oregon, and we're remodeling our house, literally tearing out walls and pulling up floors and removing barriers, and lo and behold, we're actually hearing each other better. And though we're not remodeling the house for that particular reason, it reminds me that if you want to do something well, like hear another person, sometimes you have to take drastic action. I also recognize the irony of talking to Quakers about listening. I mean, that's what we do, right? It's who we are at our core. Maybe the essential focus of our spirituality and the way that we relate to other people. We listen. At least that's what we profess. Now, how well we possess and practice this capacity to listen, well, I think that needs to be examined by the fruit of our lives and our life together, seen in our faithfulness to God's leading, evidenced in the unity and spirit of love that's being fleshed out in our community, and by how well we're connecting with the cries of the world around us and to the voices of those who are rarely heard. So by those measures, friends, how well are we listening? Despite the ironies, I think it's really important that we're talking about listening in our time and place. Recently, there have been a bunch of studies and many articles written on our culture and how just generally bad we are at listening. We're highly distracted, we're so glued to our gadgets, connected to an avalanche of information and virtual contacts, but feeling often very isolated and alone. Just a few years ago, the World Health Organization actually identified loneliness as one of the most significant social issues we're facing in our culture. It's really hard to listen and be listened to when you're so disconnected from other people. And clearly, the models that we have in the media don't help us. Talk shows and news programs where guests spend most of their time shouting at each other and the host. These, in my mind, do little to cultivate an environment where listening flourishes. And the emotional health of our culture is so frayed and fragile right now that it doesn't offer the kind of safe space for deep listening to occur. In a recent number of articles that I wrote, there was a study done on tweets and online posts, and the most prevalent emotion being expressed in social media was, any guesses? Rage. Rage. Good old rage. Feels so wonderful in the moment. It may even have a kind of cathartic value for us, but does nothing to enhance listening, let alone communicating with someone else. Now, I'm not implying this is any of or all of this is true of BYM members. Most of us have heard way too many talks about listening. We've attended workshops on silence and waiting. We've read books on centering, on prayer and meditation. You practice the ways of discerning the voice of God and tuning your ear toward that of God in other people. And thank you for that. Thank you for doing that hard work because it matters. And yet here we are talking about listening again. Why? Because I think because it's so stinking hard. Well, I don't have any new insights for you or techniques or tools to offer. There are plenty of them out there, and we need these aids to continue to build our capacity to listen to the Spirit and each other. So my focus tonight is going to be around postures of listening. Not the postures of listening, but some postures for listening, seven of them, in fact. And I will in no doubt use images and words that some of you will struggle to connect with. So my prayer has been that God is going to grant those that need it the capacity to listen in tongues tonight, beyond the words to where they come from, to hear past my very clear sense of privilege, beyond all the woundedness and baggage that I bring to this gathering, way beyond, I hope, the limits of my experience and knowledge, and even beyond all my Quaker and cultural blind spots. We need to cultivate the ability to listen in tongues, I think, and tonight it's your chance to practice. In the beginning, the Hebrew scriptures assert God spoke creation into existence. And as far as I can tell in reading the Bible, God hasn't stopped speaking since. From there, God calls humanity to love and care for creation, to walk together in intimacy and friendship with God in the cool of the day and the beauty of the garden. Even in the story where God is rejected, a persistent invitation is offered to everyone. Come, follow, listen, hear the word of the Lord. Whether it comes through the voice of a prophet, a burning bush, through a talking donkey, or some other ass like me, God's word is spoken in the hope and expectation that a willing people will hear and will understand and will joyfully obey. Later in the story, a little band of weak and insignificant people are invited to serve as light to all the other nations of the earth, by being a servant example of God's shalom and mercy for humanity. And the first and most important direction given to them was the word hear. Shema, listen, hear, O Israel. So this, friends, to me is the root, the radical beginning of listening. That there's one voice to focus on, one single note that sounds in all of creation, and our work, our glorious work is to tune our lives toward it. This overriding emphasis on listening gets woven all throughout the remainder of the biblical text. Prophets call people to listen, to be still, to hear. In John's Gospel, or in the New Testament, in the beginning of John's Gospel, it starts with the reminder of, in the beginning was the Word. The eternal voice of wisdom that spoke all things into being and is now incarnated in human flesh and giving light to all. In his life, Jesus teaches, he invites, he calls others. He reminds humans that we don't survive, let alone thrive, on bread alone. We need way much more. We need the preceding word of God spoken in time and on time to those who listen. Those who have ears, Jesus says, will know his voice and follow his commands, the greatest of which is to love God and love others. And when they do this, when the word they hear becomes truth in their lives, a watching world will notice and say with wonder, indeed, those are the friends of God. And so therefore, I think, as I think about radical listening, the first posture that comes to my mind is one of surrender and trust. Now, how you boil that down into your life, I can't say, but for me, it looks something like this, like two chairs. In my first year of college, after a suicide attempt and a drug overdose that left me entirely broken, I met the living Christ. It was like an unexpected wave of love snuck up on me, a tsunami of mercy that washed up upon my shore and absolutely turned my life upside down. It was both terrifying and inviting, because I knew as it was crashing in upon me that I could either struggle against it and stay in my wretched but familiar life, or I could release myself to it and be washed out to some unknown place, in some new direction, into deep water where I knew I couldn't stand any longer on my own. And so, having no idea what it might mean or where it might take me, I said, I trust you and I'll follow. Well, faith to me is all about trust, and it was brand new to me. I didn't grow up in the church. I didn't know the stories, the teachings, the rituals, the ministry, none of it. It was pretty much foreign to me. This meant I had no idea what prayer was, talking to and listening to God, what it looked like. The few models I began to see in my early church experience made prayer seem like an uncomfortable speech in front of a crowd or a laundry list of demands to a God who apparently seemed mostly concerned with our financial health, our financial wealth, our health, and our comfortability. The small non-Quaker church I was attending was convinced that everything God had ever said or would say was captured in the book. And so if you have questions, refer to the manual. Listening was never really brought up. Now, I liked the idea of an easy-to-read manual, but the problem was it wasn't always so easy to read. And more troubling and more important, I kept hearing this inner voice. And so as I read the scriptures and as I fumbled at prayer, I kept hearing things that my church thought was strange. In the silence, I became convinced that I needed to adopt a life of nonviolence. I became aware of my need to put off any and every attachment that would hinder my devotion to God. These leadings towards simplicity and peace seemed odd to some in the church and, frankly, un-American to others. So I kept struggling with prayer. And then one day I stumbled upon a book by a fellow named Brennan Manning, who was a former Franciscan priest. And he's told the story of someone just like me who was struggling to know what to do with prayer. When the fellow was about to give up on it, somebody told him that prayer was no different than a conversation between two people. You talk and you listen. And with God, listening is especially encouraged. So sit yourself in a chair and set up another beside you and imagine Jesus there in the other chair. After all, he's promised to be with you always. He's promised to be our ongoing teacher and guide. So trust this. Take him at his word. Say what you need and then listen. Listen as if your life depended upon it. And this practice revolutionized this man's life. When he got older and contracted cancer, he spent hours in the chair talking to Christ. It's a beautiful story, and it was so helpful to me at that point in my life. And it ended with him being found by his daughter on the day of his death, not alone in his bed, but he was kneeling at the chair where Jesus sat for so many years, with his head resting on the seat. This is a posture of vulnerability and surrender and rest and absolute trust that I think lots of us resist. It's just too uncomfortable. Now, God in the abstract, as an idea to ponder or a possibility to consider or a name to draw on when it's useful, that's safe and manageable, not too disruptive or potentially embarrassing. But a living, dynamic person, a presence who's closer than our breath, who lives up to the promise to be there, that's risky. That feels awfully intrusive, too unrestrained and uncertain. A God beyond the limits of my control has the capacity to interrupt my regularly scheduled program, could upend my life, could point me in a new direction or change my mind about something or enlarge my heart or, God forbid, explode my soul. What if I try it and find that indeed my life does depend on it? Well, if we want to get radical about listening, that is, get to the root of all things, I think a posture of surrender, whether it looks like that to you or not, is essential. Maybe you're an extrovert, and you find surrender only comes after a vigorous walk with your best friend, where you get to pour out your personal pain and your frustrations with civilization to somebody tangible, and you get to shout and cry and move about and wave your arms, all the things that we don't get to do in meeting for worship. And you do all that until that drains away, and you realize you're still breathing, you're still moving forward, but with a sense of hope, and feeling held by this calming presence, and the realization that the fate of the world doesn't depend on you. Now, however you get there, a useful line from Thomas Kelly's Testament of Devotion may help. He encouraged developing a sense of surrender and adopting what I'm calling this posture of surrendered listening by repeating the phrase, "Thine only. Thine only." Not mine. Not ours, not my time, my will, my way, my light, but thine only. I believe it was in this spirit that the early Quakers quaked, the spirit of surrender, the early Quakers quaked, and they shook the countryside for miles around. When they were able to pass through silence to a place of stillness, the place where we know in our bones that God is God and we are not. Well, I want to try to reach that place of surrender and trust long before I die. Not be satisfied sitting opposite Christ, but come closer in as though my very life depends upon it. A second posture of radical listening takes place when we turn our lives toward the healing and searching light of Christ. In his book, Encounter with Silence, John Punchin writes, "When I go to meeting with the intention of worshiping God, I have serious preparations to make. I understand Jesus to be saying, if I truly desire to follow him and enter into the kingdom of heaven, I must be willing to open my heart completely, give everything I have, hold nothing back in my secret places. I must, in a word, be willing to be searched. I must bring all the things that make me the person I am, the good, the bad, the acceptable, the unacceptable, and place them before God. I must, to use a special Quaker phrase, come to the light." Radical listening in this way means listening with God, in unedited honesty to the fullness of my life, in a work that's meant to be gracious and healing. The light of love will no doubt expose some of the shadowy places in our lives. And thankfully, this is a work that lasts a lifetime, because if the shadows were exposed all at once, I suspect most of us would feel too overwhelmed by how far we still have to go to become whole and holy. But the inward teacher knows when and how we are ready to confront the demons and desires that confound us. Under the light of Christ, my privilege is exposed, often in more helpful and transforming ways than when others want to point it out to me. Here, at least when I'm willing to listen, my pride and arrogance at being a Quaker gets revealed and tempered. My unwillingness to forgive surfaces. My fears, my anxiety, my greed, my anger, my lack of compassion, my selfishness, my biases, my complicity, they all surface in due time. They get noticed and named with a gentle and severe mercy. And in grace, I'm confronted with both the need for change and a newfound desire to face into it, often with some very specific direction on how to go about it. I'm convinced that if we're to move in the direction of actually listening deeply to and with other people, we can't skip this step of bending our own lives toward the searching light of God. In his letter from Birmingham jail, Martin Luther King writes about four avenues for social change. He mentions the basic collection of facts, that we need to start out as honest learners with a mindset that I may not know everything about an issue. Imagine that. Second is negotiation, or a willingness to come close to others and meet them where there might be common ground. The third avenue, the one I want to highlight in this moment, is what King calls self-purification. This is the coming to the light. The willingness to renounce ourselves and our own brokenness, our biases, our need to fix others or smooth over conflicts. It's coming to a place of being used rather than simply trying to be useful. He suggests it's in this process of self-purification that one may even find the strength and the wisdom to love their adversary. We're going to come back to that later. For King, the willingness to listen around our own need for change before we rush out to save the world is what enables holy transformation, or his fourth avenue of change, direct action. Listening in this way helps me act faithfully and powerfully and prophetically. He says it's often what makes the difference between being an authentic agent of reconciliation and just a well-meaning reformer who may actually be doing more harm than good. Connected to the posture of listening under the light moves us to a third way of radical listening, one in which we assume a posture of waiting. In Luke's version of the gospel, Jesus is resurrected and he appears to his disciples. They're overcome with joy and hope, fear and doubt. He speaks to them, and maybe as never before, they listen to all that he had to say about the peaceable kingdom and their place in this divine reality. "I'm going to send you to do even greater things than I," Jesus said. "But first I want you to wait here in Jerusalem until I clothe you with power." The book of Acts continues Luke's story, repeating the same phrase, "Wait here until you're baptized with the Holy Spirit." Those first men and women had a big work ahead of them. Today was not the day to just seek, but to see a world restored. Now was the time when all things were going to be made new, when the ocean of light would finally swallow up that persistent ocean of darkness. Wait? Why? What for? But in the Gospels, the disciples often vacillate between a fear to act and anxiety to do something. Does that sound familiar? A fear to act and an anxiety to just do something. Especially when the way forward is less than crystal clear, this failure of nerve or an impulse to run ahead of our guide gripped them and sometimes grips us. And it's when we're in the grip of either or both of those temptations, Spirit may be calling upon us to wait for new light, for greater insight, for the impulse of God's power, and an unseen third way to open. I didn't attend FGC this year, but I listened to Reverend William Barber's message online, which was excellent. In concrete ways, he articulates strategies we might engage in a resistance movement aimed at addressing some of the injustices in our time and place. "We need a clear moral witness," he said, "and to sound a prophetic voice that speaks to the condition of our society." And to Quakers in particular, he calls us to speak up because we must not be silent anymore. But he also said more than that, reminding us that we must first be silent. We must wait before God. We must wait in God, finding that clear and powerful guide, that authentic life and power, so that it's not simply us speaking or acting out of our own ego or our own anxiety and fear or our own need to be noticed or our own need to feel relevant. With all the crises erupting around us, the world doesn't need my wisdom. And with all due respect, it really doesn't need yours. What the world needs is an authentic, prophetic word of God that speaks directly and powerfully and transformationally in our time and place. Now, I know that a reminder to wait, especially when it comes from someone like me rather than Reverend Barber, can intentionally or unintentionally silence the prophetic voice or slow the march for justice. It's easy for me to say, wait, no, let's wait, because I don't have to live in fear each day of being harassed or detained or shot because of the color of my skin. I'm not pushed out or left out because of my gender. My children aren't being taken at a border crossing. I was in Ramallah recently, around the time the U.S. Embassy was opened in Jerusalem. On the 70th anniversary of Israel's declared statehood, on the day before Nakba, the day of catastrophe, when some 700,000 Palestinians were expelled or had to flee their homes as a result of 1948. My friends in Palestine, many of whom can't leave, encouraged me to go to Tel Aviv a day early because there was violence expected in Ramallah and there was going to be trouble getting through the checkpoint. And so I left because I could. And all I could think about as I was leaving was, how long, O Lord, must these people wait? And how empty it must sound for when somebody like me says, be patient. Across our communities, there's a growing frustration with waiting. Today doesn't feel like a day for another prayer meeting. It's time to overturn the tables in the temple. It's time to stand up, to speak up, to act up, not shut up. Like Lucretia Mott, I hear many people saying, I have no idea of submitting tamely to injustice inflicted either on me or others. I will oppose it with all the moral powers with which I am endowed. I am no advocate of passivity. Amen? Amen. Today, like all days, has no room for passivity. And a willingness to wait before God through the radical posture of listening isn't passive. It's active engagement, the disciplined commitment to stay in the silence long enough to see what love will do, what it can do in us and through those who are listening. If we truly believe that evil is only fully and finally overcome through the good, then let's not settle for short-term or short-sighted responses that relieve our need to just do something out of a sense of despair or anxiety. Instead, how can friends create the kind of spaces for deep listening whereby we and others are led into spirit-animated and empowered witness that actually makes a transforming difference in our world? The fourth posture of listening involves looking outward, expecting we will be sent out in service to others and as a witness to God's love. There's a church I know that ends its meeting for worship each week by having everybody move from the pews or the seats to the exterior walls of the sanctuary and face outward during the benediction. They do this to remember that there's a rhythm to the spiritual life of gathering and scattering. We gather in order to listen, to remember who we're called to be and what we're called to do, to encourage and strengthen one another, so that we might return then to our communities as salt and light, as agents of reconciliation, ministers of great news. On an individual basis, we're also sent. And so in radical listening, we give ear to the special concerns that God may be nudging us toward. Who am I called to contact today? Where am I to go? What step of action is mine to take in this moment? I imagine if we took the next several hours, we couldn't exhaust all the stories that we could share with one another about how God has spoken to us and called us to do something particular. Our Quaker history is filled with brilliant and bewildering tales of God calling friends to act in certain circumstances, in dramatic ways and ordinary ways, big and small ways, marvelous and mundane ways, that may not have changed the world in its entirety, but meant the world to someone or some group in a moment in time. My own stories are far less about me and much more about this amazing, living, loving Christ that I know, who speaks to me, and who continues to speak in time and on time. I want to share a couple stories that are messy. They raise as many questions as they answer. Important ones about, why doesn't God speak all the time? What happens if we're not listening? And 1,000 other questions I could think about. And you know, I don't have any easy answers for those questions. All I know is that there is a God who speaks, and I want to learn to listen as well as I am able, and learn to respond as faithfully as I can in those moments of hearing. Like the time the mother of a boy I met when I was working with teenagers in the juvenile justice system in the mid-1980s called me. She said her son had run away from home, and would I find him? Kevin and I connected when he was in the detention hall in Portland, Oregon, arrested for prostituting to feed his growing drug use. Over the weeks he was in the hall, he talked about the challenges he faced at home and at school, his hopes for the future, and how or if the God that he wished was true could actually be known and experienced in this life. Now, in 1985, Portland, Oregon was a city of about 500,000 people, and the metropolitan area was about three times the larger. And so finding one person seemed like kind of a challenge to me. But in the moment that Kevin's mother asked me to find him, I heard this inward voice say, "I will lead you to him." And God had done and would later do crazier things in my life. So I looked at Kevin's mom and I said, "I'll find him." I did find him that evening, about 2:30 in the morning, as I saw him coming out of a bar while I was walking in the downtown core of the city. Somehow I just knew he was there. And as I approached, he looked more and more puzzled. And when we were standing nose to nose, he said, "Are you looking for me? And how the hell did you find me?" And I just told him his mother had sent me, and God had led me to find him. And something struck a chord in his heart in that moment, and an angry young man became a child again. And we drove to his mom's house, we had breakfast together, and they began again the challenging work of being a family. It's been said by many people that living in the present is the premier skill of the spiritual life. Living in the present is the premier skill of the spiritual life. This moment in time, the only one that we know we have, the only one that is certain, is always the place where we can experience God's presence and make the next faithful step of obedience. When I was a friend's pastor in Oregon, a marriage erupted in our meeting. The husband came to see me to talk about whether I could do some mediation. When we spoke the next day, so we talked about it, and when he spoke the next day, he was still quite upset, but eventually, as he talked, he began to become more settled, and he agreed to give his wife some needed space and promised to check back with me the next day. 15 minutes later, as I was sitting at my desk, a voice, one that I had never heard so clearly, said, "Go to his house right now." It almost shook me out of the chair. And when I hesitated, it thundered to me, "Go now." So I drove 20 minutes to his house, and as I walked up the steps to knock on the door, I was standing on the porch, and I happened to glance off to the side and look through the open door into his garage. And there he was, hanging from a rope from the rafters. And I rushed to him, and I held him up as best as I could, and I stretched out to a table near me and got a knife and cut him down, and we both fell to the floor, and he was lifeless and still. I went into the house, and I found a phone, and I called 911, and I came back, and I worked with him for several minutes, but I couldn't get him to breathe. I could not get him to breathe. And so suddenly he gasped. He took this desperate gasp for breath. about the time the medical team arrived. The paramedics didn't expect him to live. When we got him to the hospital, the doctor didn't imagine he'd live, and if he did, he would have suffered severe brain damage. But you know, he did live. And there was no lasting trauma noticeable in his life. Moments in time matter. Paying attention to God, to the call to go, to be present for others matters. Now, like I said, this is not an easy or neat story. It's theologically really troubling to me. I've been involved with enough suicides to know that a voice doesn't always intervene. And probably all of us here have been impacted in some way by suicide. And we carry pain and so many questions about why. And for the life of me, I can't figure it out. I can't explain it. I can't explain why there's ever a call to go, or for reasons big or small, or why they don't come to us all the time. All I know is that I want to be paying attention when that voice is speaking to me. So let me shift focus for a moment and talk about adopting a fifth posture of listening. Listening as if we're written on one another's hearts. Are we at the core of a collection of individuals, simply a collection of individuals, or is there an equal or maybe even greater reality and mystery that we are being remembered by God into a single living organism, a body comprised of many interrelated and interdependent parts? The answer to that question has huge implications for us. 2 summers ago, a traveling friend from another country and I kept bumping into one another. It wasn't you, Jolene. I stalk other people too. And so we kept bumping into one another at various FUM yearly meetings in North America, including this one. Each time we saw each other, I asked her, "What are you hearing among us?" When we crossed paths the last time, she said the overwhelming takeaway for her was how U.S. Quakers of all stripes spend so much time talking about me and very little time talking about we. And my sense is she's right. We're really good at owning our own spirituality. But it is more problematic for us in this culture to think about being a people of God. And it has implications for our witness, for how we work through conflicts, for our capacity to articulate and live into a coherent identity that we can invite others into. In the early days of the Quaker movement, during the contentious time, Fox wrote this: "To all friends everywhere, dwell in the truth and walk in the love of the truth, in patience, and learn that good lesson of Christ Jesus, to be low and meek in heart, giving no occasion to the adversary by doing evil. But walk honestly and uprightly, for the upright and meek in heart know God, and God delights in the upright and righteous. But all friends, mind that which is eternal, which gathers your heart together up to the Lord, and see that you are written in one another's hearts." A connection this deep, in which we're joined together in mutually dependent and resilient and interwoven ways, is radically different than just being a collection of individuals who happen to share the same space or claim a common religious label. Our attachment is rooted to our life, our shared life in God, who binds us together and calls us to be in harmony with one another. This makes our Quaker meetings and churches laboratories for discerning God's leading and life, for learning how to live in to the unifying presence that transcends and transforms our differences. Here in these places, in your home meeting, you get to practice and practice some more, not just the easy stuff, like how to come to unity around an issue or to approve a budget or to fine-tune the wording of a minute. That's the easy stuff. The bigger challenge and more important work is how our fellowships become practice fields for love, for forgiveness, for patience, for forbearance, for mutual accountability and discipline and eldering and support and generosity and all the things that are so easy for us to talk about but really challenging to live out. And if you think it's hard on a local level to do these things, imagine what it's like on a yearly meeting level, where we bring people together from scattered places and states, and in 5 days we expect them to listen to the voice of God without conflict or fail and not be in conflict with each other. What a dumb idea. And yet it's absolutely vital to our life in God. Now expand the circle a little bit more beyond the insular nature of our yearly meetings to include friends along the theological spectrum and across cultures. Here in the U.S., some friends are looking at the issue of racism, including BYM. And I told Ned I would say this, and I would only say it was because it's true. I think Baltimore Yearly Meeting is doing some of the best and most Spirit-led work around this issue. And I want to encourage you around this. I go to all the yearly meetings, and I've heard the conversations. And though it may not feel like you've made much progress yet, you're doing good work. So keep it up. But where we've not even begun to scratch the surface is when it comes to our North American biases and perceptions toward friends of other cultures. I think Georgia communicated really clearly to you that we in North America are the vast minority of friends in the world. We are the minority, but you'd never know it by the way we act. Because of our resources and other privileges, we completely dominate the conversations about what it means to really be Quaker and what Quakers will be doing. FUM's actually made a good deal of headway around expanding the dialogue and changing the structures, but we have a long, long way to go. Ann Riggs and Georgia Fuller and Michael Newart, people from your yearly meeting, have done an important work supporting the largest population of Quakers in Kenya through the work at Friends Theological College. They've helped nurture the voice that's arising from the African context, one that's gaining expression and courage to speak. And my question is, are we going to be ready? Are we going to be willing to listen for it? Will we mind that which is eternal and see that friends from other places are also written in our hearts? And some days I'm not sure. Several years ago, I served as an elder at an international Quaker gathering in Kenya. Probably because of my role in FUM and from connections that I've been privileged to make, many of the African friends came to talk with me about their needs when time arose. Listening to their stories, I've never been so embarrassed to be a Quaker from the U.S. You're just ignorant, several were told by loving friends. When you have 100 more years under your history, your history of history under your Quaker belt, then you'll see things just like we do. An elderly, lifelong Quaker saint, a woman I know and respect, was told by a very young friend from the U.S. at the rise of a worship sharing session. We have a long way to go in learning to listen as a global community. And frankly, I think the world needs a global witness of Quakers who love one another and work together. The world's dying for that kind of witness. It's one reason why I am so committed to FUM, because it's trying. But it's going to take some really radically committed people, ones who are willing to listen to others, not just as if they're written on one another's hearts, but because they know they are. And they're willing to engage them in the deepest possible way. Since I'm talking about listening tonight, I'm not talking much about speaking up. And we, of course, we do need to speak up. We need to stand up, to shout for justice, for peace, for truth. We all know the church has been silent for too long, and I do hope that this is changing. But as we listen for the prophetic word that we're called to speak, I think a sixth posture is essential. It's what I'm calling the posture of persevering proximity. Brian Stevenson is a lawyer and a writer who's working on issues of mass incarceration. He tells a provocative story in his book, Just Mercy, on how his understanding of race and incarceration and the death penalty was transformed by actually being with and listening to young black inmates. What he found, and what so many of us find, if we're fortunate, is that concerns of this magnitude are not, at the end of the day, a social issue to fix or a political problem to be solved. Whether it's incarceration, immigration, sexual or gender violence, clean water, hunger, poverty, outreach and evangelism, what we find when we actually get involved, when we get our hands dirty, when we get up close to the people in that situation, what we find beyond our debates and ideological positioning is a person with a face, with a name, a person who's a child of God. Stevens, who's as committed to legislative change as anyone, urges us to get close to the people most impacted, to hear them, to know them and be known by them. Something profound and powerful happens when our work for peace and justice or any other cause is consistently grounded in living, breathing partnerships with others. When real people get to tell their stories and share their experiences and their perspective and their wisdom, and that becomes part of shaping the direction of the work. These are the people who keep us from losing sight about why we're doing what we're doing, who help us resist the temptation to make everything about us or getting noticed or caring who gets credit. These are people who help us not lose hope when structures are so slow to change, who help us from becoming too over-reliant on advocacy and legislation as the only means for transformation. I absolutely believe in the need for political engagement and advocacy that help us address the structural and systemic problems of our day. And I'm grateful for groups like FCNL and AFSC that enable our collective efforts. But I've also been reawakened in the last few years again to the necessity and powerfully transforming impact of people who just quietly and joyfully are at work in their communities, persistently engaging real people with compassion, by inspiring hope through a ministry of presence, creating relationships where love is shared, where listening occurs, and the shalom and mercy of God are made visible. As I mentioned, John's gospel begins with the image of the eternal word being made flesh and making its home among us. We're called to continue this work. This is how Paul describes it in Ephesians chapter 2. It's by God's mercy that you've been saved. Whether you want to answer the question or not, Jolie. You receive this gift through faith. It wasn't our plan or our effort. It's God's gift, pure and simple. You didn't earn it. Not one of us did. So don't go around bragging that you must have done something amazing. For we are the product of God's hand. Heaven's poetry etched on lives, created in Christ to accomplish the good works God arranged long ago. That's how Paul describes the work of the church, that we are God's workmanship, or more literally in the Greek, God's poem, continuing to be spoke in time and on time for the sake of others. And I think it happens most powerfully when we assume a posture of listening in proximity with others. I've talked way too long, but I want to end with a final seventh posture of listening that I think we can't dare to forget in this time of division, separation, and bitterness. And I want to call it the posture of impossible reconciliation. Right now I'm reading Miroslav Volf's great book, Exclusion and Embrace. Volf is the director of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture, and he's written extensively on the intersection of spirituality, culture, and politics. He is a Croatian Christian who lived through the Serbian War and who came from one of the most marginalized communities in that time. The book emerged out of a question posed to him by a professor during his graduate study. Could he, as a Croat, ever really be able or be willing to embrace the Chetnik? Could he really imagine the possibility of being reconciled with Serb fighters who, as he says in the book, sowed desolation in my country, herding people into concentration camps, raping women, burning down churches, and destroying cities? It's a brilliant and disturbing book, which tries to consider one of faith's most vexing questions. How does one remain loyal to both the demand of the oppressed and to the gift of forgiveness that the crucified offers to the perpetrator? Do you see it? How do you remain loyal to the victim and still open to the possibility that the victimizer can receive grace? Or are they mutually exclusive? Or is there some third way that leads towards a more full and beautiful reconciliation and restoration? Volf doesn't offer any easy answers either, only admitting that from a human perspective, it just seems totally impossible. But as a follower of the crucified one and risen one, he believes it can be and must be possible. So in an era where we're rightfully focusing on the demands of justice, Volf is raising an important matter that we will one day have to return to. How do we embrace the other, the enemy, the one we most despise, the Chetniks of our lives, who perpetrate such horrible things? And how do we do this without losing our identity, without compromising our values or minimizing the atrocities that they're committing? Volf suggests that no authentic reconciliation is possible if you disregard justice, and equally no genuine justice is possible if you don't pursue reconciliation. One of my friends is a Mennonite theologian who did a great deal of post-war reconciliation and research work in the Balkans. He said one of the most powerful and socially transforming works of peacemaking occurred in small fellowships of Christians who in very practical and often hidden ways reached out to former enemies with kindness and compassion, believing this was both the way of faithfulness and the fulfillment of peace with justice. These Christians didn't give up their identity in doing so. They didn't become doormats, nor were they silent when justice needed to be spoken. But they also didn't give up on the other, write them off, disengage, or finally exclude them. And it was messy. My friend called these small communities of Christians islands of hope in a culture that had reached a place of despair. Friends, who's your Chetnik? Who's the one that you are not sure you can bear any further? Who you have so much trouble understanding and tolerating? Who's the person or maybe the group that you most want to give up on as a lost cause, who you don't want to listen to, let alone embrace? Just after college, I read a piece by the Catholic worker Dorothy Day. The phrase that haunted me and still haunts me today is, You only really love God as much as the person you love the least. You only really love God as much as the person you love the least. Every fiber of my being wanted and wants to resist this. Everything within me protests this cannot be the case. But I'm pretty sure it's true. And I see the question that Wolf is raising as particularly important in our time. In our divided culture and within our disintegrating communities, even within our fracturing yearly meetings and conflicted local meetings, who are the people who are going to take up the impossible possibility of reconciliation between those who can feel like they can no longer embrace each other? How? I don't know. All I can imagine is staying engaged, continuing in a posture of listening to those who've hurt us, who've betrayed us, who we've come to despise, and doing so without denying ourselves. We may be rejected. More frighteningly, we may look into the eyes of our enemy and see a small reflection of ourselves. Maybe our enemy is not our complete opposite. Even more shattering to our worldview is the possibility of discovering the one we despise is more complex than the caricature we've constructed. Or the position they hold, which we so vehemently reject, is also a little more complex than we wanted or want to consider. When it comes to being a prophetic people who want so desperately and urgently to change the world, I'm mindful of what an African-American Baptist preacher told me several years ago at a peace gathering. You can't be a prophet among people you do not love. Today, in our time, I might add, especially among those we love the least. Can we imagine ourselves, friends, as more than prophets, but as ones who will be used to do the impossible by listening for ways to reconcile ourselves and others to those who today seem to be standing beyond the reach of love? May the members of BYM find great joy in listening to and following God together. And may the fruit of your lives and life together bring about the peaceable kingdom and the beloved community of Christ in our time. Peace to you.
Friends, Jolie just told me that I'm the one that's supposed to invite you to ask questions. And Colin just told me that he'd appreciate it if I answered them. So let's take a deep breath. It was quite powerful. And the floor is open for your reflections and queries. Jason, over there.
Thank you, Colin. You remind me of the cartoonist Walt Kelly. I trust you won't mind if I refer to him. And his cartoon where he had Pogo saying, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." On a more serious note, my answer to your question is Desmond Tutu.
I actually have a question.
You have a question.
When you were talking about reconciliation, can you speak to the Quaker reconciliation in Burundi and Uganda?
No. A little bit, although Adrian Bishop, I think, just walked out of the room, and he would be great to do that. I know of the work. Yes, I do know of it. I also know of the work that FUM does through Friends Church Peace Teams. And it's a powerful work where I think about one instance where on Mount Elgon, which is a remote part of Kenya near Lugulu Hospital, if that's a place that is in your conscience, there's a mountain in the western part of Kenya where during the post-election violence there was some of the most brutal fighting that happened along tribal lines. And it was out of post-election violence that Quakers got together and said, "This is our place. God is calling us to do the work of reconciliation here." And so FCPT was formed, and they went into places like Mount Elgon and did that ministry of proximity, of getting to know people and listening to them and building trust and hearing their stories, and into the place where then finally the two sides were able to come together and talk to each other. And one of the most powerful pictures I have on my laptop, I should have brought pictures to show to help keep people awake tonight, but one of the most powerful pictures I have is one of our FCPT people sitting between a man who had killed the husband of the woman sitting in the chair opposite him, and allowing her to share her pain with him, and for him, for the first time, really understanding the trauma that he had caused to this family and to this tribe. And FCPT, as well as the Great Lakes initiatives, have done a great job of helping with programs that bring healing to communities, that provide peace resources. It's very, very powerful. It's very different than the kind of peacemaking that we often do here, which often is on a very kind of ideological level. There, it's very much on the ground and very powerful.
And if you don't mind, Colin, I'll add to that. Our friends are still on Mount Elgon, and it still has some danger. When I was teaching just this last April, I was talking to my students that pastors need healthy boundaries, such as turning their phones off at night. And two of them said, "No, they never turned their phones off." I said, "Why?" And the other students said to me, "Because they live on Mount Elgon, and they have to be able to be warned if they need to flee." Next question. Reflection.
Pastor, wouldn't you say that America is a lot more violent than...
Let's wait till you, Sinclair. We'll get a mic for you. I know you have a big outside voice, but there are people over here that need to hear you too.
St. Clair Allman, Richmond Friends Meeting. I appreciate white people, black people, or any people that help the African people, but isn't it true and fair to say that it's a lot more violent here in America than it is in Kenya, or Kigali for that matter?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Partly because Kenya has very restrictive gun laws. I mean, people don't own guns there. So the violence is, sure, it's much more limited than it is here. And brutal nonetheless.
Jim?
Last month, I had the fortune to visit Iglesias Amigas in Indianapolis, and it was a 6 p.m. worship service. This is part of Indiana Yearly Meeting. And I arrived 25 minutes early, and whereas after 6 p.m. the service was one of praise and electric guitars and drums, when I arrived, the friends gathered, including the young children, 5 to 10 years old, were all kneeling on the floor with their elbows on their metal chairs, sometimes whispering personal prayers and sometimes in silence. And so they were physically in a very humble position in relation to the presence. And a few days before, they had heard the news that 3 children of their community had been reunited with their mother, Sonia, in El Salvador. 3 American citizen children born here, but their mother was detained in April and deported. And they were experiencing gratitude and many other mixed emotions, I believe. And I just, when you were speaking of postures of listening, I repeatedly was seeing the image. When I first arrived, I looked in and felt like I would intrude. And I looked in through the door. This is what West Irvington Meeting was, an Anglo meeting that has ended and now is a Spanish-speaking evangelical meeting. And so everything around me was the library and the books of an Anglo unprogrammed Quaker community and now reborn in this evangelical Spanish-speaking form. And not speaking Spanish, I could just only listen with my heart. But the posture of supplication and humility in listening to God is what I learned and want to lift up for us today. And even in the tragedy of deportation, finding something to be grateful for. That's an eighth posture that you might take as a question if you choose to.
I can stand. Martha Hanley, Hopewell Center. Can you speak to that posture of listening where we're able to quiet the voice that says, who, me? You're speaking to me? And am I worthy? And what, really, now?
So one of the most transforming spiritual disciplines that I've adopted about 15 or 20 years ago comes from the Ignatian tradition, which is learning to see yourself as God sees you. So I grew up in a quite dysfunctional home. I told you a little bit about, you know, my struggles with drug abuse and suicide. And the story I always like to tell is that in my home, my father was, who I get along with great now, was an angry, unhelpful man. And he couldn't imagine ever, one of the things he used to say a lot was, sorry isn't good enough. When I was a teenager, he would say to me on occasion, when you get big enough, I'm going to beat the stuffing out of you. So I always say, that's why I stopped growing. It was a self-defense mechanism. And so those tapes of not being worthy and not being good enough and not imagining that God could use somebody like me played really loudly in my head. And so this prayer exercise, this Ignatian prayer exercise of learning to see yourself as God sees you was tremendously powerful for me. Because when I do that, when I practice this discipline for stretches of time, and I still do it some, the thing that I always hear is, you are my beloved child. And I always tell people that that's what they will hear. You will hear that voice that will come to you and say, you are my beloved son. You are my beloved daughter. You are my beloved child. And the amazing thing about that message is that you can't touch that, right? Nothing you can say to me can take away from that because God has spoken that into my life. And suddenly I'm freed now. I mean, it frees me to act courageously because I'm God's child. It also frees me from, on my better days, from having to feel like I have to prove myself to anybody or appear to be something that I'm not, because I'm God's child and I don't have to impress. I can't impress anybody. Why try? So that's a practice for me that is all about listening, because sometimes it takes me a while to hear that message.
Walt.
My name is Briette. I'm a member of Charlottesville Friends Meeting. I live in a rural Augusta County in Virginia. I don't think this is working, so I'll just try to see if it is. Okay. I live in rural Augusta County in Virginia. And I wonder if you can speak to what happens after perhaps successfully listening to somebody who has a completely different set of facts that they're working with, that their reality or their world construct is so different. Say I or we are able to listen successfully to that, but we don't want to just listen. We want to make bridges, or we want to move to encouraging other kinds of facts. I'm trying to say this delicately, but I think, so listening, yes, but then what?
Right. So if we can reframe this question, maybe if I'm understanding it, are we talking about it in the context of a meeting where maybe you're talking about in a meeting with around doing something together, or?
Thank you for the opportunity to clarify. No, I'm speaking more politically in terms of our political culture, where there is a strong divide, it seems, between different sets of facts. I'm privileged enough to have a variety of opinions that come through my Facebook pages. But even where I live, my neighbors, my friends, my teacher, my children's teachers, their facts are very different from my facts.
Right.
And so even if I am able to listen deeply and with care and with compassion, but I don't want to just listen. I want to encourage bridge building and encourage alternate ways of viewing facts. What comes next, perhaps after deep listening?
Right. Georgie, you want to answer that question?
Good joke.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, you can tell your good joke, then I'll answer.
I'll give Colin time to think. In 1982, Langley Hill sent me to England as a mother for peace to dialogue with the Soviet women. It was the same month that they accepted my membership, and I was wondering if there was a subtle message there. After about a week together, we started gaining a certain amount of trust from the Soviet mothers that we were with. And one of them had been at Kent State as a Fulbright scholar. She spoke English, very well educated. And we were in New York meeting, and she turned to me, and her face was pained. And she said to me, remember 1982, we really don't want to be in Afghanistan. It's costing us money, it's costing us lives. We really don't want to be there, but a friendly socialist government asked for our help. What could we do? And I looked at her and I said, I completely understand. That's what they told us about Vietnam. And I think in time you too will find that it was wrong.
Is that good? Give it time.
There's, of course, no easy answer to that question because it sounds like you're living in it. And it's, I'm sure you've worked really hard at being compassionate and trying to present information. The thought that comes to mind was an example in my own life when I think it was the second Friends meeting I pastored. It was in rural southern Idaho right after the outbreak of the first Gulf War. And it was a really politically tense time, especially in southern Idaho, around this issue. And in the Friends Church even, there were several people who thought nonviolence was absurd and, you know, a ridiculous response given the state of the world. And so I had been clerk of our Peace and Social Concerns Committee when the church called me, and immediately one of the people, a farmer, came to by the office one day, and he picked me up and said, let's go for a ride. And we drove out to the field, and we were driving along, and he said, don't bring any of this peace garbage to the meeting. Which is a great way to start a conversation, it seemed to me. And so I listened to him, and we talked about it, and he shared all the reasons why peacemaking and nonviolence could work and why it wasn't really the Christian response and why it was so helpful for the U.S. And so in that moment, there was nothing. I couldn't present him with any information that was going to change his mind. What I could do was continue to stay engaged with him, continue to provide him with opportunities and examples. I'm focusing this around peacemaking or nonviolence. I purposely over time got him involved in stuff where peacemaking and reconciliation took on a far more practical, a much more hands-on, in his sphere of influence kind of approach than some ideological issue. And over time, this fellow became much more warm to looking at another set of facts, of reconsidering his position. And in fact, when there was a conflict in the town, later on, he was our strongest advocate for not responding in what I would consider a violent way. So I'm not answering your question, but I just see it as continuing to labor with and try to find different, more practical ways to reframe the issue.
Rich Liver Sage, Sandy Spring. Friends often view the way our customs as the best way for us to hear the voice of God. You are describing a number of other ways that you have found God's voice. Can you describe the breadth of your exploration in finding God's voice in your life?
I can't answer that one.
I think we're out of time. Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've tried to be as open as possible to different ways. Again, my experience was coming to faith in college after a crisis, and I got involved in a Bible church, and their approach was you understood God's leading by listening to the fellow up front. And that was helpful for me, actually, for a season. And then I found service, which is clearly a way that Quaker spirituality is the crucible, which a lot of deep spirituality gets formed, became for me one of the places where I experienced God incredibly transforming ways. And also put me in contact with people who are different than me, and that was in its own self enlarging. So service certainly was one. You know, I think one of the things that we all probably experience here is our willingness to engage in the sufferings of others is one of the ways where our spirituality deepens. I've read as much as I possibly can extensively. One of the reasons I went back to work on my doctorate was I wanted to do something on spiritual formation. How is it that we're actually made into the image of God? That's the goal of what Christianity is about, really, is that we might be remade, transformed into the image of Christ and continue Christ's work in the world. Well, how does that happen? Well, there's no six easy steps. That I'm convinced of. But it's a lifelong journey, and how do you keep tuning your ears to God? And so, you know, the book that actually led me to Quakerism was a book written by Richard Foster, who was a Quaker, Celebration of Discipline. So he, in that book, outlines like 12 or 14 spiritual disciplines that are meant not as rules to follow, but as openings, ways in which we encounter God through worship, through prayer, through confession, through community. And I happened to be at that time in my life in a small group of saints who were just light years ahead of me, and to be able to watch their example and to wrestle with them around those disciplines was very transforming for me. So that's a few things.
You're absolutely right that we're about out of time, because we're supposed to end about 9. When I asked you, should I tell people what you're going to do next? Because, and you said, I'll do it. So tell us.
Okay. So over my 30 years with Quakers, I have been demoted from member to pastor to yearly meeting superintendent to general secretary of FUM. So I've about run the gamut of employment with Quakers. And so now that I can't get a job in our faith community, I've been hired by the Mennonites, actually. So I can work my way down the ladder there over the last few years of my life. The Mennonites have an organization called Everence, which used to be Mennonite Mutual Aid. And they do tremendous, really tremendous work. And they invited me about the time I was leaving FUM to consider to come work for them. And so I'm going to be their Quaker liaison to organizations, yearly meetings, nonprofits, meetings in churches, and do some teaching in a program they do called Creating Generous Congregations. It's a really wonderful workshop training methodology to help congregations, meetings, and churches think about how are we generous within ourselves, but also into our communities. And so I actually started 2 days ago working for them. My first day on the job was here. So thanks for getting me out of a lot of work already. I really appreciate it. And it's been great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks very much, everyone. And we still have things that we can do, like going to the Intervisitation Lounge.
graciously to talk with us. I would appreciate that. Yeah. And I want to